do such a thing for them. So my tell the story simply in order to show that it's not that Avital was ready to pay any price.
No,
she was ready to pay price on Soviet spies, of course, but not on the principles.
I just want to say, because it bears mention, when I was once asked, you know, what brought about Natan's freedom, I said that two things. One was his own inner moral resolve and moral courage. Without that, it wouldn't have happened. I said, but the second thing were the two most important women in his life, his mother, and I think it bears recall here, a courageous woman who would travel in the dead of winter to bang on the doors of the Chistopol prison for the visit that was promised every 6 months, and then to be rebuffed and turn away. And I think I told you, I saw what Chistopol prison was like when I had an opportunity to go there in 1990. And I saw the conditions under which Natan lived and survived. And I have to tell you that these were the kinds of things that can only attest to a person having enormous, enormous inner resources, you know, not only physical, but moral, in terms of freedom and identity, to be able to survive. And to have had with him at all times in that struggle his mother and her courage, and Avital, who became the voice of Natan outside of prison around the world. Probably the most compelling voice, as we will recall, internationally in the struggle for any political prisoner anywhere. And she became, in effect, the voice, if I could say, the face of Natan, a more attractive face in a certain sense, becoming the person who was such a compelling figure that wherever she went, she was able to mobilize political leadership all over the world in his cause. I know Natan knows and appreciates this, and then retreated into the modesty that she felt was really her life's work with in Israel, with her children in social work and the like. But it bears mention with respect to appreciating the two courageous women who played such an important historical role. Natan, we spoke a bit on this Fear No Evil, but the second book, which was really, you know, one on how one mobilizes, you know, the forces of freedom, you know, to combat the struggle of Arab tyranny and terror. Now we are in a situation of that world, the Arab world that you wrote about at the time, and confronting the forces of tyranny and terror. How do we confront and relate to what is happening today in the Arab Spring, or some say evolving Islamist winter? What is the role of the West? What is the role of the free world, as it's sometimes called? And what is the role of the Israel and the Jewish people in this particular challenge and struggle?
As you know, Irving, we were for many years, and maybe even today, we are a minority, you and I, and those people who really believe that to support dictators is always a bad thing. Because the policy of the free world on Arab street for the last 100 years was that we are supporting dictators who are loyal to us. Not only we support, we are creating dictators. Britain created a set of dictators in the beginning of the 20th century, together with the country. They created Saudi Arabia for this tribe, and they created Jordan for this tribe, and they created Iraq for this tribe. And they said, we'll do everything that you'll be strong, but you deliver us our interests. And it worked for 100 years, and one day it exploded. And they were people like you, but also like the democratic dissidents in the Arab world, who were explaining that it will explode one day. And they were explaining it exactly as Soviet dissidents were explaining, that when people are kept by force in fear, they cannot express their opinion. At some moment, it will explode. At some moment, when the regime will become weaker, or they suffer so much that they can't continue, they'll start speaking their mind openly, and the regime will fall apart. The free world didn't want to hear it. There was a very meaningful and important conversation, 2007, which you know very well, which is important to repeat. In 2007, democratic dissidents from Middle East were convened on the on global forum, which convened Václav Havel and myself in Prague. And I convinced President Bush to come there and to talk to each of them. And there was Saladin Ibrahim, Egyptian human rights activist. Irwin Kotlin, of course, was his lawyer when he was at the time in the Egyptian prison. And he was released because of President Bush. President Bush personally threatened with $2 billion assistance if he would not be released, he was released. Here he is meeting with Bush. He thanks him for his being released, but he challenges him, why are you supporting Mubarak? Don't you see that he's a corrupt dictator? And President Bush gives him the answer, which every American president would give, and every Israeli politician would give, and every European leader would give. They say, but we understand that if it will not be Mubarak, it will be Muslim Brothers. And we want Mubarak and not Muslim Brothers. And Saladin Ibrahim said to him, that's your mistake. If the only choice which people have is Mubarak or Muslim Brothers, corrupt dictatorship, or this ideological fundamentalist, in the end it will be Muslim Brothers. And see that Israelis have this experience. When the only choice which we left to Palestinians was corrupt thugs of Yasser Arafat or noble terrorists of Hamas, they voted for Hamas. So it is that the longer you keep Mubarak at power, the bigger will be popularity of Muslim Brothers, because that's the only organized force. All the rest is destroyed, put in prison, and the West is blessing Mubarak for this. And so that's exactly what happened. That there are many people say, oh, why if only Obama didn't betray Mubarak? Well, first of all, what? Obama could send American troops to fight for Mubarak. Already there was a revolt. Millions of people said they don't want him. But second, if Mubarak stopped being president maybe 10 years ago, then Muslim Brothers maybe would have 10% support. We know that they were growing with every year. In 10 years, they could have already 100% support. So if you understand that it is inevitable what's happening, there are so many evidences, predictions by democratic dissidents that it will happen. If you understand it's right. And if you understand that the longer these dictators exist, the stronger is fundamentalist movement. So you should wish that it will happen as soon as possible. Now, when it happened when it happened, so now there is a majority of Muslim Brothers in Egypt. What can be done? Look, the new situation in the Arab world is that for the first time there are governments who will depend on the will of their people. At least for the time being, they're too weak now to remove democracy from the scene. So they depend on elections. So they depend on whether they deliver goods to their people. They are so poor. They are so destroyed, they so urgently need assistance. So if America and Canada and all the free world will link their assistance in rebuilding their countries with the question of civil society, until even Muslim Brothers will have no choice. Because at this moment, they have to deliver goods to their people. And it's opposite to Mubarak. Mubarak, his strength was different. He signed agreement with Israel, but he turned his society into the most anti-Semitic society in the world. There were more anti-Semitic books published in Cairo under Mubarak than in any place in the world. Why? Because that was his way of survival. The fact that he signed agreement with Israel doesn't mean that he can get rid of external enemy. He needed to continue his dictatorship. And that's why he needed that his society will hate us. And we lived with this. We believed that the fact that we have peace agreement, it was let's have them suffer under this dictatorship. It doesn't work this way. It's challenging times. It's not simple because democratic forces are not organized. Facebook generation has no idea in working together and building organizations. But they can. In the next 5-10 years, it will be very critical whether they will build a civil society. So I believe it's challenging, but it's an opportunity. And if you look at the alternatives, there are no good alternatives for the free world anyway.
And what is our role? Is it that of an observer to watching how this Arab Spring unfolds with the threat of an Islamist winter? or do we have a particular role in that regard? In other words, if there is a democratic process, so a democratic process with the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt could be a democratic process as with Hamas, which is one election, one vote, yeah, one time. And so what do we do with respect to the process as it's unfolding in Egypt and the Arab world?
There is, first of all, Muslim Brothers, if they come to power, they will come to power now. They will be very weak in terms of the challenges which are facing their people. On the other hand, there are big non-organized group of people who simply wanted to live without fear. If you watch what were these events about 1 year ago, you put on Google demonstrations in Egypt, anti-Israel expressions, and you will find like 10 references. I did it. Demonstrations in Egypt and anti-American expressions, maybe 50. And then demonstrations in Egypt and speaking your mind freely, something like this. You'll get 1 million. 1 million. Because that was all about how people finally felt that they want to express their minds freely, especially new generation, organized through Facebook, but not organized politically. So the where at this moment $2 billion of American money go to, they continue giving them now to the military regime, and they will continue giving to the government. These $2 billion and many more have to go to all this dialogue which now is between student organizations, trade union organizations, and women organizations, and universities which have special programs of democracy education. The businesses which have to be supported should be not government businesses, but only free market businesses, joint ventures between the free world and them. There is critical mass of millions of people who want it and who are not organized. And there is government which maybe gets 60% of the votes and it doesn't want it, but it's too weak to resist to this. That is the moment when the West, all these NGOs which are only talking and talking and talking about human rights and condemning Israel for violation of human rights, that's for them to deliver, and to deliver in practical, real work in the Middle East.
Let me just parenthetically mention, there is a political prisoner, the first political prisoner in the post-Mubarak era. His name is Michael Sabir. He's a young Egyptian blogger, 26 years of age, one of the early voices of in Tahrir Square, one of the early hopes for the Egyptian Arab Spring. He was the one who proclaimed at the time that the army and the people are of one hand. That is to say, the army and the people are working together. When he saw that the army was suppressing the people, he then said, the army and the people are no longer of one hand. For that, he was charged with insulting the Egyptian military, brought before an Egyptian military tribunal, sentenced to 3 years in prison, and as we meet, he is in the 106th day of a hunger strike, his life hanging by a thread. I mention this because these are the kind of people with whom we have to stand in solidarity. The subtext with regard to Michael Nabil is he's also a member of the Christian Copt community, and also spoke out publicly for normalization of relations between Egypt and Israel, and said he would not join the Egyptian army because he does not want to shoot Israeli soldiers. So I mention his case because I believe this is the kind of person that the free world, so to speak, to use that term, should be highlighting his case and the kinds of people we should be standing behind. Natan, on the question of mobilization and the like, if you look, and just moving on to another topic, if we look at Israel's evolving history, there have been, four fronts against Israel, and they've all been simultaneous. The first was the conventional Arab wars against Israel. You had the 48 war, the 67 war, the 1973 war. It's an understatement to say conventional. I mean, these were wars with terrible tragedies and loss of the best of Israel's young people. The second was the, and we sometimes forget this, the economic war against Israel, which began also in 1948 with the Arab boycott, has in some sense morphed in different ways, but is still there. The third was the terrorist war against Israel, which began also shortly after the creation of the state with the Fedayeen, and then now in its present form with Hamas and Hezbollah, Islamic Jihad and the like. I think it's important to recall Hamas and Islamic Jihad and Hezbollah, Natan knows so well, are not just terrorist entities, though that would be bad enough. They are terrorist entities that have a genocidal objective, that are anchored in an anti-Semitic ideology, and use terrorism to further that objective and that ideology. So that's a third front. A fourth front is the missile front. That began with the missile war in 1991, the Iraq Scud missile war. Ariel and I were at that time living in Jerusalem. I remember because I was speaking to our neighbors and I was saying to them, you know, it so happened that I was in Israel as a student during the 67 war. I also was there part of the time as a visiting professor during the Yom Kippur war. I said, I'm back here now again. It's the Iraq war. They said, tell us when's the next time you're coming. We won't be here. But it gives you a sense, and I was just visiting, you know, cameo shots. But this is the kind of ongoing life that Israelis are experiencing. So these are, let's say, four fronts. But we now have a fifth front, recognized by the government, the Jewish people, of which you've been one of the main actors in that and combating that front. And I'm referring to the delegitimization front. And, you know, delegitimization is not a new phenomenon. We've always had the delegitimization of Israel. It began with the reference to Israel as an original sin, its creation, Zionism, etc., in 1948. What is different today is the masking of delegitimization or the laundering of delegitimization under the cover of all the things that are held out to be good, all the public value, the protective cover of the United Nations, the imprimatur of international law, the culture of human rights, the struggle against racism. The whole objective being to posit Israel as the enemy of all that is good and the repository of all that is evil. That's what makes this delegitimization so difficult, because it's the laundering of delegitimization, in effect, also under the rule of law, which has also become to be known as lawfare. Natan, you've experienced this. You've experienced this as an Israeli. You're experiencing it and seeking to do something about this as the chair of the Jewish Agency. You know how this is being played out here in the campus culture. How do we mobilize with respect to this fifth threat, the threat of delegitimization, which is perhaps the most sophisticated of the threats for some of the reasons that you and I have shared before?
Yeah. Well, first of all the previous wars that you mentioned, we won these wars and we won big. We won all our military wars, and of course now we have the Iranian threat. If you look at the last 15 years, what's happening with the Iranian threat, we are winning this war too, in different ways. The war against terror, well, we defeated them during Second Intifada, and I was in the government with these very difficult decisions, how to send our troops to Jenin and other places. But we defeated them, and today Hezbollah and Hamas have a big problem because their base in Syria and in other Arab countries is falling apart. They don't know where to put their headquarters now. So it is a problem, but let's understand it. How big is our victory over there? Economically, look where America is economically, where the free world is economically, and where Israel is economically. Startup nation, a real nation which fully depends on one thing, Yiddishkeit. In fact, now I'm really concerned, because for all these years that we depended only on our Yiddishkeit, we were doing better. Now that we found gas, who knows what will happen with us? That like with all those Arabs who found oil. So I'm a little bit concerned. But otherwise, now, as to the delegitimization campaign, it is direct continuation of the thousands of years of anti-Semitic campaign. And it is very important to understand the nature of it. And that's why I proposed in the past 3Ds, demonization, legitimization, double standard. These are the main tools against Jews, which are applied at this moment They always are applied against Jewish identity. When Jewish identity is religious, they are in religion, anti-Semitism, Christian anti-Semitism, rather. When Jews are nation, national anti-Semitism, which brought Nazis. When Jewish identity is dependent fully, not fully, greatly, on Israel, on connection with Israel, they are against Israel. Well, because Irwin is much better scholar than I, so he didn't accept Semitism. He has 10 principles. It's okay. I don't remember all 10 principles. I can't remember so many things. That's right. But if you understand that that is the heart of this problem is anti-Semitism or attempt to destroy us as the people, then the answer on this, as through all our history, is only nation building, only strengthening ourselves. And by the way, I understood that is a big threat, because in 2003, when in the second, 2003-04, when I was in the second Sharon's government responsible, among other things, for fight global anti-Semitism. And I came to Ariel Sharon after my first trips to American campuses, universities, and said, our major battlefield for the future of Jewish people is in American universities. And I wrote then an article, Traveling to Occupied Territories, where occupied territories were universities. But by the way, the first time I understood how big is the problem was in Canada, in York University, when I was traveling and meeting with Jews, with non-Jews, challenging, fighting, debating, so on. And it was a very good experience. But when one young Jew in York University told me, for me as a liberal Jew, will be much better if Israel will cease to exist. Because then I am not responsible for all these awful things. Give me the reason why Israel should exist. So I found a reason to give him. I don't ask your parents how looked the world when Israel didn't exist, how you as a Jew looked, and then many other things. But what really is the aim of our enemies with all this campaign of delegitimization? The aim is to disconnect Jewish people, young Jews from their people. Because the moment you decide to distance yourself from Israel, and I know that now I know hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of cases of young kids who, while on the campus, decided that it is better for their career, it is better for their relations with the people, it's better for their life to stop for some years being involved in anything Israeli. The next step is always anything Jewish. And the next step, they simply disappear from our people. And that's a big problem. So if you understand that that is the direction of this attack, then you understand that the only way to resist to this is to rebuild this connection. That's why when I came to Jewish agency, finally given the opportunity to say something about Jewish agencies. And I proposed that we will broaden our activities on the campuses. I was told by something like Jewish agency, it's like the main organization which exists between the Israeli government and Jews of the world, which was created by Ben Gurion in order to build this connection, to embrace all the Jews of the world in support of Israel. Jewish agency is not political. We are dealing with everybody. And you propose us to go into political campaign on campuses. I said, you know, if you think that on campuses the battle is who is right, Likud or Kadima, whether disengagement or Oslo, it doesn't interest anybody. The real issue is whether Israel should exist or not. So the aim of our enemies is to disconnect young people. That is the mandate of Jewish agency, to reconnect Jewish people with Israel. So on specific on campuses today, this year, on the 1st of September, we sent our 50 shlichim, 50 Israeli fellows on campuses. Last year it was 35, the year before it was 15. Every year we wanted that on every university where there is 1,000 or more Jewish kids, and in America there are more than 100, there will be a special Israeli fellow on campus who after the army, after their first degree, trained, know how to debate, will try to bring as much of Israel as possible to the campuses, to bring as many young Jews to our different numerous programs of Israel experience, to Israel. And the most important thing is to build a core of 10, 20, 30 young Jews who are not afraid, who are not scared, who know how who know the truth and don't know how to defend the truth. Because I saw it many times. The moment you have young, even small group of young Jews who are ready to stand up, our enemies have no arguments. Our enemies really have no arguments. All their attacks can be successful only when it is slogans, when it is passion, and when there is no inner logic. So it is a very important battle. Jewish enemies now is very actively involved. We, in Canada, we have, I think, only one or two shlichim. In America, we have on this issue. But we can have more because that's very important problem.
Let me just take up on that point, because the campus culture is a unique culture today. And the campus culture, and it's been like this now for some time, is very much a human rights culture. And in that human rights culture, the Palestinian cause has become the poster child for the human rights cause. And that puts the Jewish student in the campus culture today in a dilemma. If he identifies with Israel, he at a time when Israel appears to be antithetical to the human rights cause, then he's estranged from the very culture that he is a part of. On the other hand, if he identifies with that human rights culture, where the Palestinian cause is the poster child for the human rights culture, he may be estranging himself from his Jewish identity. So how do we bring about a case whereby the Jewish student can identify, and you're the best to respond to this and to lead in that journey, can both identify Jewishly and with the Jewish identity and identify also with the human rights culture? And what role can the Jewish agency play in that regard? Because we have the phenomenon, the related phenomenon, that while the student is trying to do all this dilemma, we have the backdrop of assimilation. And so these are all things that, you know, intersect, and this is where I think is a particular challenge for the Jewish agency.
Yeah, of course. Look, why I came to Jewish agency, really, when Bibi Netanyahu wanted me again to the government, and they said, I was 9 years in prison, 9 years in Knesset, now. I was in four governments, and I resigned twice. And I was in four prisons, and I never resigned. So then they said, I don't want to be the chairman of Jewish agency. Why? Because Jewish agency is always concentrated. That's the constant dialogue between Israel and diaspora. And at this moment, we have to concentrate on two major challenges. On one hand, in addition to saving Jews, which of course, we are saving Jews from Ethiopia, we are saving Jews from Venezuela, we are saving Jews from Iran, today, unfortunately, from Turkey. There are approximately 70,000 Jews who are in danger. But the biggest danger, by far the biggest danger, is that every day we have a few hundred Jews less physically, disappear in this world because of assimilation. Few hundred Jews every day are less, on one hand, and isolation of Israel. And it's two parts of the same problem. Why? Because if we are strong in our identity, if every young Jew feels himself connected to the history, to community, to the state of Israel, both of these problems disappear. So, because Jewish agency from the very beginning, that the agency of meeting between Israel and diaspora, we are very well built for this. We have now our Masa program. Masa program is bringing young Jews for up to 1 year, from 6 months to 1 year to Israel, on different tracks, whatever they want to study. There is somebody who wants to study physics, or somebody who wants to study kulish, to be chef in Novosibirsk. One guy who potentially was a good leader, he decided to invite him to Israel. He said, I want to be chef. So we have hundreds of different professional tracks for all these people. But while they are for a year in Israel, they are potential Jewish leaders, and they are learning how to be Jewish leaders. These people, when they're coming back to the community, these are our main soldiers. Yesterday, at the meeting with the United students, I saw two people from after this program. It's already a different world. They will not be afraid on the campus to challenge others, because they lived there for a year in a very active, involved way. So must have as many different type of Israeli experiences possible. For example, we found out that there are many Jews who are not ready to go for 1 year. They won both rights for 10 days. With it. So now we are building a special program of internship. You can come for 2 months for internship, for improving your profession. While in these 2 months, of course, we will try to connect you to this feeling of pride, of being proud Jew and connected to Israel as much as possible. And there's a huge potential. This you really can build young leadership all over the community. But the other thing is that's exactly with what you're saying. For young Jews, they want to be involved in human rights. They want to be involved in justice in the world. And many of them feel that the less Jewish it is, the better, because it's the same dilemma which I was facing when I was involved in two movements. So there is a lot of projects of Tikkun Olam, of repairing the world, in which American Jews created these programs, are leading these programs, but there is no, it's like the way to disengage yourself from Jewish world. We are now proposing, we start now different small pilot projects, so they can become very big, of Tikkun Olam, Jewish Tikkun Olam, meaning that, let's say, a group of Jews from Israel and from Canada goes to Argentina or to Brazil or to Ethiopia. And there is a lot of positive activity can be done. But while doing it, at the same time, you're learning why it is a very Jewish thing to do and what your Jewish heritage doesn't allow. So we have to go with these young boys and girls who are for human rights. And we have to show them this deep connection. And then, don't forget, there is always another way to express your Jewish identity, to make Aliyah. And this year, by the way, there were almost 20,000 new immigrants.
I just, on that point, because I know that we have to conclude, I just want to, right at the end, go right back to the beginning and ask you a question. It's the 20th anniversary, really, of the fall of the Soviet Union. You can say, going back to 1967, the 45th anniversary of the birth of the Jewish national movement in the former Soviet Union. How did a small movement effectively not only electrify the Jewish world and the struggle for Soviet Jewry and the connection with Israel, but effectively also help bring about the downfall of the Soviet Union? What is it from that great heroic struggle, which I don't think has any parallel anywhere in our time? What was it that brought about such a heroic struggle and such a heroic achievement, and what can we learn from it for what we need to do here?
Look, all these theories that I was talking about, all these conclusions about freedom and identity and dictatorship, it all comes from my experience with this movement. Because I really believe that we Jewish people, in our time, in our generation, 20 years ago, did something absolutely unique and important to the history of the world. Because all the strength of, I was speaking how Soviet Jews discovered their identity, so discovered suddenly they have history. It happened with all the Jews of the world. That suddenly we could never survive if there was no this hundreds and hundreds and thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of Jews who discovered that we are their family. I was asking many times all these housewives who were coming to Soviet Union and were bringing us books. And they were bringing us books and they were Magendovitz. And they were trembling from fear how they can be arrested and it will confiscate. And then they are taking from us letters. They had to deliver to this organization, they will do it to Senate and to Congress and to Senator Jackson and to make a big mess. And they were trembling even more because they can be stopped in their underwear, these letters. And I'm asking them, why are you doing it? Why you have 3 kids, you have such a good life in New Jersey or in Toronto or whatever? In the Montreal. I was told many times, when you're on Montreal, don't mention Toronto. I sent him 1,000 times. So, Montreal was also very good. So, I'm asking, why are you doing it? And they're saying, because it gives meaning to our life. We discovered our family. So, this is such a simple thing, but how it happened to be so powerful. Jews are the rediscovering their identity. They're discovering that their story is much more powerful and interesting than they thought. And they mobilize themselves. And suddenly, we go on demonstration, 10 Jews in Moscow. We are arrested. And 100,000 Jews all over the world are going on demonstration. And then KGB tells them during interrogations, who is supporting you? Bunch of students and housewives. This army of students and housewives for 20 years was going and demonstrating and pressing all the politicians and making them to pass resolutions. And suddenly, all the Soviet Union is paralyzed. It's all paralyzed and cannot move without giving some concessions to Soviet Jewry. And the moment they start doing concessions, they fell apart because if they don't control the minds of the people, they cannot survive. And they didn't stop controlling the mind of the people when Jews rediscovered their identity. So it's such a powerful story, and here I'm only surprised, every time surprised and deeply disappointed by the fact that American and Canadian Jews and European Jews are looking so hard how to find the stories which will rebuild the pride of their children being Jewish. And they are looking at the history, they're trying to tell the history. And here you yourself had such a great victory. Why did you forget to tell to your children about your own victory? That's it, I don't understand.
Opportunity for an encounter with someone who was a leading and inspirational figure in that struggle and in that victory. It is a story that we need to tell to our children, because there are Natan Sharanskys out there. We have to role model Natan for our children, for our community, because as I say, we are in the presence today not only of someone with, and that's how I began, with which I close, who was recognized in Washington as a great scholar, statesman of our time, but as somebody who was a heroic figure in both the struggle for Israel and the Jewish people and the struggle for human rights and peace. And that's where identity and freedom come together and are personified in one person, Natan Sharansky, who is the role model for all of us. Thank you.